From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's a best of music show today, starting with local jazz pianist Mark Davis.
Then why musician Sarah Arroeste writes and performs in the endangered language of Ladino.
I didn't want the culture to fade out with my generation, so I felt really compelled to honor my grandfather and all of my relatives who came before him to make sure that this culture lived on.
English folk musician Josiette Clark explains why most of the songs she writes are maybe a little gloomy.
I kind of feel like joy is something that you go out and experience, and it doesn't take a lot of working through. And I feel like that's why art places more emphasis on the more difficult, kind of melancholic, reflective things we think about.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. One of the hallmarks of jazz is that its players know how to improvise. So it would seem that the idea of teaching improvisation is a contradiction in terms.
Not so, says Mark Davis. He is professor of jazz piano at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music, a busy practicing jazz musician, and the author of the new book, The Hal Leonard Jazz Piano Method, The Player's Guide to Authentic Stylings.
I met up with Mark Davis earlier this year in one of the conservatory's practice rooms, and he talked about his career in music up till now.
You know, I've been teaching for quite a long time. I started teaching here at the Wisconsin Conservatory back in 1992. And so it's been, I guess, sort of a laboratory of experimenting of many different methods for teaching jazz. And I've, over the years, developed my own method for teaching, which is certainly based on other musicians that I've interacted with and people I've studied with. But I've come to a certain way of presenting the music and a way of getting students to be able to play authentic jazz. And so I felt it was time to put it into a book form and try and reach a larger audience. Fortunately, I had the opportunity through Hal Leonard.
Talk about authentic jazz. What does authentic mean to you? And when you are teaching students, what is the authenticity that you want them to attain?
When I use the term authentic, really what I'm referring to is playing in the tradition. Because jazz music is a tradition, it's a long history, not as long as the classical music history or other ethnic styles of music, but jazz got its start in the early part of the 1900s, and even from the very start, players like Jelly Roll Morton and James P. Johnson, Duke Ellington, these players were part of the beginning of a tradition that has extended up until today. And so jazz musicians still very much base their playing and their inspiration on players from the past. So I wanted to create a book that would introduce students to some of the techniques that have been used by many of the great jazz pianists throughout history.
So techniques like what, and what would make them different from, say, classical piano technique?
Well, of course, in jazz music, we're improvising. Well, certainly classical musicians of the past used to do a lot of improvising. Bach, Mozart, and others were, of course, great improvisers. But in today's music, jazz is the art form or the musical form that has really retained this tradition of improvisation. So that is a big part, of course, of the book, showing students, pianists, how they can go about creating solos, how they can go about improvising music.
It's funny because I think of improvising where you might have the key structure in mind, but the improvisational part is not something you can write down or necessarily practice. It's supposed to happen in the moment.
Well, I always try and make that point to students and as well as in the book. Sometimes I think the nature of improvisation is somewhat misunderstood. I think sometimes people think, well, if I'm improvising, that means I shouldn't have anything pre-planned. I should just wing it. Really, it's kind of just the opposite. It's, as if you were going into an adventure somewhere, a trip, maybe an unknown place. You'd want to be prepared. You'd do your best to prepare. You'd bring certain things along. You'd have certain skills that you would have ready to go in case of anything that might happen. So as an improviser, we want to be prepared. So that's what we practice. We practice being prepared for all kinds of different situations that come up. And so rather than in the case of some styles of music where we might work out one way to play a piece, the jazzy musician works out many, many, many different ways they might approach a piece so that at any given moment, I can go a certain direction one way or the other.
Can you give me a small example of what you're talking about? Like maybe the tune itself and then a couple of different ways you could go with it?
Sure. Maybe I should pick something that would be familiar to people. Over the Rainbow?
Sure.
Let's try that. And I'll do a little bit of the melody and then I'll move into some improvisation so that you'll be able to hear how I start moving away from what people expect to hear into something that's improvised.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I obviously heard the melody the first time through. And then when you went through the second time, it's like the structure was still there. The chords
right.
of the song were still there. You could kind of hum the melody in your head over or under what you were doing. But you kind of just really had a lot of fun, mostly in the right hand in this case.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes I encounter people that are a little mystified by jazz, and they wonder what exactly is going on. I heard the melody at first, and then suddenly it seemed like you weren't playing the tune anymore. Of course, that's the improvisation part. In many ways, jazz is like a theme in variations, where we play the song, and then we go into variations on the song, which might involve changing the harmony or changing the rhythm, or, like you mentioned, experimenting and changing the melody. I tried to refer back to the melody a few times so maybe you could hear kind of where I was in the song, but at times I was playing, improvising melodies that were completely different than the original melody of the song. I mean, the basic form in jazz typically is that we would play the melody and the song pretty much how someone might recognize it right off the bat, and then we would repeat the song with these variations and then return at the end to the familiar melody. So like you say, it kind of brings things back home.
Do you find sometimes in jazz that you're also improvising into different keys? Or are you going around depending on the song and what you're trying to do? Or is that beyond what you're trying to do in this book?
Well, the book is certainly geared towards someone who plays the piano, but perhaps has never played jazz before or doesn't know much about it. Although within the approximately 100 pages of the book, it gets fairly advanced, and I think someone could spend quite a bit of time working out of this book, maybe several years even. And in fact, I should probably practice out of the book myself, because there's really no end to any aspect of improvisation or jazz. There's no end to where we might take a particular concept. We can keep going with it. So some of the things you mentioned, like playing in different keys, changing keys, are certainly elements of the book, learning how to transpose and whatnot. And some musicians will play a song and then change keys sort of midstream. But, you know, sometimes that is a more advanced kind of technique.
When you are teaching these various things, like how to approach taking a melody and playing with it, what does the book show? Are you writing it out? Is there an audio part of it? How is it working?
Yeah, everything in the book, and there's, I think, 200 examples, and they're all recorded. I recorded them. Some of them are solo, and some are with a trio. I had a couple of my friends that are great musicians here in town, Jeff Hammond on bass and Dave Bayless on drums, record with me. And so we recorded all the examples. So someone who gets the book can listen to every musical example that is notated in the book. Learning to play jazz is very much like learning a language, which personally I never successfully did. But
music is a language.
It really is. And so some of the book is approached that way. I mean, there's certain basic elements that one needs to learn, but I get into the very specific vocabulary of jazz. Much of it, of the vocabulary in the book, and when I speak of vocabulary, I'm talking about musical vocabulary. So it might be a short phrase. It might be a four-note lick, something like that, that I would present to students and then show them how they can use that short little unit, that little melodic idea, almost like it's a word within a sentence. So by connecting some of these short little phrases, we can start creating longer lines, just in the same way we create sentences when we speak. So I might take that little lick, and I might combine it with a scale. So I started with a little scale, then went into the lick. Then I might have some other little phrase that I want to play. Perhaps it's... So I've got these two little ideas, and this one. And so I'm connecting those together using scales. Now I've got a longer line, kind of like a sentence, a whole phrase. And so that's really a lot of what the book focuses on, learning the basic scales, but then learning this vocabulary that one can use to start constructing these longer lines.
Do you find that pianists who come from a classical tradition have more or less difficulty dealing with improvisation? I mean, classical pianists are so used to reading the music.
Right. You know, and here at the conservatory, I have so many different kinds of students. We're a community music school. So I sometimes teach students who have no classical background. Some have degrees in classical piano. You know, certainly the technical aspect of learning to play the piano, learning the correct way, the classical approach to piano, is very, very useful and helpful. And it just depends on the person. Sometimes I encounter people who are kind of afraid to put the music away and start improvising, to play something other than what's written on the page. So sometimes I find that younger students are a little more open to that. They're not afraid to experiment a little bit and try something, because there's going to be a lot of things that people play when they start improvising that really don't sound very good. There has to be a lot of experimentation that goes on.
And a willingness to not sound good.
Exactly. The whole pursuit in my philosophy of teaching is not really to worry too much about how do I sound. It's about the process of learning to play this music, because frankly, most musicians aren't satisfied with how they sound. It's an endless pursuit. Even players like, I was just listening to an interview with Hank Jones, the, as you know, one of the greatest jazz pianists of all time. He lived into his 90s, and even late in his life, he was saying, I'm not quite there yet. I'm getting closer. I kind of think I know where I want to get to, but I'm not quite there yet. So even in his late years, he was practicing several hours a day and just trying to get to that point.
Do you think it helps musicians when they are approaching jazz and approaching improvisation to have a kind of a basic understanding of music theory and like chord structure and that sort of thing? Because then you don't have to think about where you are on the keyboard.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes people will ask me if I'm performing somewhere, and maybe they'll come up after and ask. They're a little curious how this music is being produced, and they ask if I'm playing by ear or do I have everything memorized. Those are certainly important aspects of playing jazz, is having certain things memorized and using your ears to be able to play certain things. But like you mentioned, Bonnie, really understanding how music is put together, the mechanics of it, the theory of it, is what enables a jazz musician to be able to create. So everything that we play as a jazz musician, we have an understanding of why we're playing it and what kind of place it serves within the music and how it relates theoretically in terms of the chords and everything that's going on around it.
Yeah, because otherwise it's cacophony, particularly if you're playing in a group.
Yeah, absolutely. And to purely rely upon our ears or to have everything memorized, well, first of all, to have everything memorized would not be jazz. We need to be able to create spontaneously and improvise. But to just use our ears and not have any understanding of what we're doing isn't quite enough either. We have to have the background. And so in the book, I do a lot of explanation of some basic theory, scales, chords, things that any pianist would need to know in order to play this music.
Do you find that it's helpful for pianists to be able to read chord charts, like guitar chord charts?
Absolutely. To read chord charts is essential. Jazz musicians often play from what we call a lead sheet. So it would just have the melody line, the part that you might sing, or that a horn player might play, or the right-hand melody that I might play. And then there are symbols for the chords. And so I need, as a jazz pianist, I need to know how to interpret those chord symbols. And that's one of the essential skills that a jazz pianist must know. And it's one of the things that I cover in the book.
Well, can you leave us with a little bit of something else that you might cover in the book and give us an example of what that might sound like?
Sure. Well, in the book, I do cover a lot about jazz harmony, learning to play chords, all the beautiful sounds that we can create. I don't cover all the possibilities, of course, but there are so many beautiful sounds we can create as jazz musicians with harmony, with chords. So I'm going to play something that has some beautiful harmony to it, something written by Duke Ellington, entitled Prelude to a Kiss.
Mark Davis is a jazz pianist, arranger, and professor at the Wisconsin Conservatory, and his newest book for Hal Leonard is called Jazz Piano Method, The Player's Guide to Authentic Styling.
We spoke with him in a practice room at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music on Milwaukee's East Side. Coming up next on our Best of Music show, some music in a different language, one that many thought was extinct. We speak with Ladino singer Sara Aroeste when we return on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Tú nos das gracia, tú nos das vida, tú nos das esperanza, tú nos das pra- Back in November, Milwaukee audiences had the rare opportunity to hear a musician performing in Ladino, an endangered language. But before 1492, Ladino was the language everyone spoke in Spain. Once the Jews were expelled from that country, however, the language went with them, collecting other linguistic influences along the way.
Sara Arroeste is a contemporary Ladino singer, and she's working to ensure that not only is Ladino preserved, but that it's updated. Before she performed at the Latino Arts Center, she joined us via Skype and explained that even though the language is endangered, she's hopeful.
There are pockets of communities around the world that still speak it. The truth is that no one will ever be born speaking it again as a first language. That's really the distinction. But plenty of people do still have a connection to it and do still speak it, but no one will be born speaking it again.
Oh, that's sad.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes my job difficult because most people have never even heard of Ladino. And the historical truth is that it was a language spoken by thousands and thousands and thousands of people for centuries, primarily throughout the Mediterranean. And it's, you know, it's devastating to know that a language so rich with history and culture is fading.
When you listen to it, you can hear the Spanish, obviously. There's some words that are absolutely the same, like esperanza and oro and things like that. What was the other language that kind of melded with it to make it Ladino?
Great question. Well, there are a lot of languages, actually. So Ladino at its core, you're right, is Spanish, but it's 15th century Castilian Spanish. So before 1492, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and more, we were all living fairly peacefully together in the Iberian Peninsula. And then around 1492, when groups who did not want to convert to Catholicism were kicked out, they left and carried with them the Spanish that everyone was speaking at the time. Jews in particular didn't know that they wouldn't be returning to Spain. So they took that Spanish and it was basically ossified as that old Spanish. And they didn't have access to how Spanish developed into the vernacular today. So they took that 15th century dialect of Spanish and combined it with bits and pieces of languages from the countries where they ended up settling. The primary migration was towards the Middle East, towards the Ottoman Empire. So think about all the countries you would encounter from Spain, let's say, all the way to Greece. So along the way, they picked up bits of French, Italian, Arabic, Greek, Turkish, Hebrew, and more. It really is a pan-Mediterranean hybrid language. It's just a cultural treasure. It's so beautiful on the tongue because it really combines some of the best components of all these beautiful languages.
One of the things I find interesting is I think of it as a Jewish language in particular. After the expulsion, as you say, you know, they took it to different parts of the Mediterranean where they were welcome. But it's different than, say, Yiddish, which is a combination of Hebrew and German. So it started out as its own, very own thing.
You're right. You know, Yiddish really is a combination of German and Hebrew, where Ladino isn't exactly that same equivalency. It does have other components. It is known in some parts of the world as Judeo-Espanol or Judeo-Spanish. So one can think of it like Jewish Spanish with other elements as well. And the Hebrew was very, very important. There are a lot of elements of Hebrew that have influenced the language. A lot of the Hebrew, though, was really kept to the liturgical Ladino and the synagogal language that you would see in the prayer books. But everyday spoken Ladino, it did have Hebrew, but it also had all of these other elements combined. And, you know, it's sort of like dialects even within, you know, within America, whether you're from Tennessee or you're from Maine, you know, your dialect or your accent of how you speak English would be slightly different. It's the same thing in Ladino. If you ended up in Greece versus if you ended up in Turkey, you would have certain words that were distinctly regional for Turkey or for Greece.
Now, your family is Greek and Macedonian, is that correct?
That is correct.
So you have the Balkan as well as the Ottoman Empire influence in the language that you speak.
Indeed. Yeah, my grandfather, Ladino was his first language. He was born in a town called Monastir, which today would be within the borders of Macedonia. But at the time, it was the Ottoman Empire. And although his extended family was really from Greece, he always called himself a Turk, as was common in that time. You know, it was really part of the Turkish Empire. And so we had a lot of different languages. He actually went to a French school. It really is this amalgam of all these different cultures. And it's one of the reasons why I fell in love with it.
I was going to say, is it because of your grandfather that you were exposed to it, and that's what you decided you wanted to do, how you wanted to sing?
Yeah, I was always very influenced by my grandfather. He was really the patriarch of our family. But I have a story that's not particularly unique to me, in that it's a pretty typical immigrant story, which is to say that my grandfather and his family came to America escaping war. In his case, it was actually the Balkan Wars. They really wanted to leave the old country behind and become American. So sadly, a lot of the cultures were not passed down to my mother's generation, including the language. So I had a lot of awareness growing up that I came from this very proud Sephardic family. It was evidenced through the foods we ate, through the melodies of the songs that we sang, and certainly Ladino was a part of that. But it wasn't a part of our everyday existence. And every time I asked older relatives to tell me more about Greece or about Macedonia or about Ladino, they either didn't want to share the information with me, or they had lost it and they just didn't have answers for me. And I was really frustrated as a kid, because I just remember loving this culture so much and wanting to know more, but not having access to the resources. And that really inspired me to create those resources for my own peers, because I didn't want the culture to fade out with my generation. So I felt really compelled to honor my grandfather and all of my relatives who came before him to make sure that this culture lived on.
Well, and what you've done musically is so interesting, because you've taken your writing and singing in this wonderful, and it is a very melodic language, because, you know, Spanish is very, it just rolls off the tongue in a lot of ways, but you've melded it with a lot of very modern, you know, jazz influences. And then we were talking before we actually started the recording, where it's like there's house and there's like, you know, techno, and there's all this other stuff. And then there's also things that sound like you would have heard them 300 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, my influences are very wide. I've never shied away from the fact that I'm also a woman born in America. I can't hide the fact that I wasn't born in Macedonia myself. So I'm very influenced by rock and pop, as a young woman having grown up in America. But I'm very, very inspired by historical memory and my own family story. So I try to meld in my deep, deep respect and honor for my Sephardic culture with some of these other musical influences that I grew up with. You know, I had to really fight to win over some of the purists in the field, because when I started off, there really weren't that many people doing contemporary Ladino music, because, you know, preservation is a really tricky concept, especially with a culture and a language that is so endangered. It's so critical that we preserve the culture that already exists and make sure that stays intact. But as much as I respect that viewpoint, I firmly believe that preservation also means that we need to be creating new material in this culture to help it live even longer. So a lot of the work that I do is not only writing my own material, which is quite rare in this language, but I also reinterpret some of the traditional repertoire to fit more of my own worldview today. For example, on my album Gracia, there is a wonderful song about a tiff between a mother and a daughter. And for many years, centuries, shall I say, the song, in every recording that I'd ever heard of it, was really from the mother's standpoint of a mother warning her child to be careful about the men that she encounters, and that she should stay as pure as possible for as long as possible. And in my reinterpretation of this song, I did it from the daughter's point of view because that's the experience that I know. And I gave it really a whole new interpretation using hip hop and spoken word and really about young women taking control of their lives and of their bodies. And it's just a new way of looking at that song. And so that's what I do with a lot of the traditional repertoire, which is that I give it a contemporary spin based on my modern worldview.
I am you, you are me, we are fire.
When you come to places like Milwaukee, which you are doing to perform here, what is the response that people have to the music and to the language? Do you find that it's mostly Jews who are interested, or do you find that everybody just kind of goes, wow, I had no idea?
I really think, or at least I hope, it's the latter. One of the things among many that I love about Ladino is how universal it is. And I've been very careful in my career, which now spans almost 20 years, to be as inclusive as possible. And I've really have stuck to a very secular repertoire. I'm interested in the folk tradition, not so much the religious aspect of it. So I really pick songs and I write songs that I think everybody can relate to. So in my audiences, yes, I'd say that primarily Jewish people would come first because they are the most likely to have heard of Ladino, but I do a lot of work with Hispanic and Latino communities. And so I find that a lot of people are just fascinated by the connection to Spanish and to Spain and to world culture. So I do a lot of work in world music communities. And the response, you know, after 20 years, I'm still out there performing, so it must be positive.
Yeah, you've done lots of different albums, including a recent one for children.
I have, and that's, you know, so dear to my heart right now. It just came out this year, and it is the first ever Ladino children's album, and I'm so proud of that fact. It was written truly as a labor of love. I wrote it while pregnant with my first daughter, and I recorded it while pregnant with my second daughter. So it really spans this experience of new parenthood for me and is directly inspired by my children. I wanted to make sure that Ladino will still exist when my daughters grow up. So I wanted to make an album that could be as easy and fun as possible for families and educational institutions to be able to learn Ladino together. So all of the songs are really repeatable and catchy and fun and just talk about basic experiences like brushing your teeth in the morning, different meal times of the day, different family members' names, things like that. And I love the album and I hope that it will leave an imprint on the Ladino cultural landscape.
Are you speaking Ladino with your girls?
Well, they're very young. My one of my daughters just turned one yesterday.
Oh, congratulations.
So, I am trying as much as I can. It's mostly through music right now. And, they love the music. I'm definitely teaching them the songs. And I'm certainly sprinkling in words where I can. It's an uphill battle. And I know that it will be a challenge to teach them Ladino. I do have the opportunity to connect with peers all over the world every day in Ladino. Thank goodness for technology, especially for saving endangered languages. It really has made Ladino preservation much, much easier through different Facebook groups and Google groups and various other mediums. It's been one of the best parts about my career has been connecting with Ladino enthusiasts and scholars all around the world. And so we read and write together in Ladino every day. I hope that my children will have that same opportunity. We'll just have to see.
Ladino singer and composer Sarah Aroeste performed at the Latino Arts Center back in November. There is more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now, and then our Best of Music show continues with an in-studio performance from the English folk duo of Josiane Clark and Ben Walker. Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
My hand on his shoulder, his hand on my knee, the cut of his collar is what it will be.
Josiane Clark and Ben Walker recently finished their first ever U.S. concert tour. The folk duo have won major awards and have a strong following in the U.K. where they live. The irony of their first attempt to get to know American audiences, however, is that their new album, called Overnight, came out here weeks after they returned to the other side of the Atlantic.
We were fortunate enough to spend some time with them before they played for a Milwaukee audience, and they shared some songs from the new album with us, including this one called The Light of His Lamp.
From stars in the sky, the light of his lamp is on tonight. The light of his lamp is on tonight.
Josiane Clark and Ben Walker in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
There was a review of your music. I think it was a concert review, I think, rather than an album, in The Guardian that led with a declaration, Josiane Clark is a singer-songwriter obsessed with gloom.
That's about right. Yeah.
it's a line I think that the writer meant as a compliment, too.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly take it as such. I'm always drawn to the more melancholic songs in any other artist's collection. And I kind of feel like joy is something that you go out and experience, and it doesn't take a lot of working through. And I feel like that's why art kind of often places more emphasis on the more difficult, kind of melancholic, reflective things we think about. Because it's kind of cathartic to work through that, both as the process as a writer, but as a listener as well. Kind of, I feel like it's quite natural for it to be that way.
Ben, do you have a relationship with gloom?
Certainly.
Yes. Like, sort of the small towns in the UK sort of lend themselves to, you know, it's
breeding grounds for gloom.
Yes, not the most exciting of places to sort of grow up. So you sort of it kind of becomes part of your DNA, I guess.
Do you feel like I was speaking with another songwriter not long ago, and we were talking about the tension that she felt was necessary in her songs. Is there tension in melancholy?
I certainly think so. I think that. There's lots of unanswered questions. And I personally, I write a lot about the passing of time, which is quite tense. I think it's kind of one of those things where you're like, time always appears to be working against you. And that's certainly a tension. And it, you kind of have to make your peace with that. And I'm still writing about it, so I clearly haven't.
But presumably, if you ever completely worked your way through that, you would be into the joy phase and the songwriting would suffer.
Yeah, I think I just lose songwriting altogether. I think I need a certain amount of doom and gloom and tension in my life to keep that going. Yeah, can't get too happy or it won't work.
So I was reading back through the archives of your blog. And after getting lost in it for the better part of an hour, the first question I have is, why did you stop writing it?
I just got very busy. And I guess it was kind of quite self-indulgent, that blog anyway, that I just, things that like made me wonder or annoyed me just ended up in the blog. I feel like for a while I've had one brewing, so I think there'll be another one soon, because like, in the last year, so much has changed for us. In the UK, we got we were in a play at the National Theatre, and we won a folk award, and then we signed to Rough Trade Records, and kind of everything went a bit mental for 12 months, and that's probably stopped me writing the blog. But
do you feel like you only have so much creative output at once?
Yeah, like I was kind of using it for a lot of other stuff. Like we've done an album in that time. And but I feel like I've got like an absolute wealth of material for a few posts now. So, you know, keep tuned in, because I'm gonna be doing one soon.
You wrote a lot of thought provoking stuff there, and I mean, you just said you were, I don't know whether you were worried, but you thought it was self indulgent, and I wonder, do you feel like is blogging self indulgent in a way that songwriting is not?
Oh no, they're both utterly self-indulgent endeavors. I felt like doing both of them was probably taking up a bit too much airtime for everyone.
One of the topics you touched on, though, in those days, and I imagine you have not given up your interest in, is kind of the nature of folk music, or maybe the box that some people want to put it in. Do you see, is there an evolving definition of what folk is?
I think the definition has always been evolving. I think that its resilience is in part due to its ability to change. And I think you're always going to get sort of Puritans who want to keep it a certain way. And to do that is to strangle it. And I think you have to let it adapt to the modern world. And I feel like in the UK, certainly we've come up against a little bit of resistance here and there with people who don't want it to change from the very narrow parameters they've given it. On the other hand, kind of the term folk has been appropriated in a very commercial sense, and that's very worrying and damaging as well. And I think that we kind of had a bit of a rocky limbo there for a while, but I think it'll settle itself and change.
It's sort of migrated its way anyway, hasn't it? Because we've now got this, you'll get folk, and then you'll get, certainly in the UK, you'll get trad folk or traditional folk. And that's a different style again. And you get the same sort of thing over here. You've got sort of storytelling folk and things like that. And it's a very, you know, even when you get down to sort of country and Americana, they sort of seem to be catch-all terms that the larger umbrella might well be considered as folk music. But there are so many subgenres underneath that.
But on the other hand, there are people who believe that you can't add to this canon of music, that it's a closed shop. And that's just not true, because it's based on songs that were written by normal people, you know, since the beginning of time. Like, that's the premise that it's based on. So you have to add to it. Otherwise, it's just going to be a kind of museum of music. And I don't believe that's how it was ever meant to be.
Right, you wonder if people were complaining when Gregorian chant came out.
What's this new horrible noise that they're all making, these kids doing their Gregorian chants? Yeah.
I trust you probably do not have a Gregorian chant you're going to share with us, but maybe you have another song?
We do, yes. We're going to do the title track from our new album. The album has a 16th century lute ballad on it, though. So, you know, we're harking back.
Overnight, early morning, London time, I was waking, I remember all the time. A sleepy sight of first light, I was waking, I remember all that night. Under cover of dark, I saw
song.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again. So as we're having this conversation, you're just finishing up your first U.S. tour, and I'm curious how much of your experiences seeing live music that other people have played over the years shape how you pull together your 45-minute long or hour-long sets?
I don't know if they do. Like, I think... I'm quite careful with how I put a set together, and like it has a kind of progression in it, and I want to take people somewhere, and I'm like very deliberate about where I put things, and I kind of think of it more like if you were putting together an album, like what would you require it to do rather than a gig. And so I think in some ways that we come out with a set list that it, like, I don't think other people put set lists together like that.
No.
It's all really slow, really quiet. And we kind of go from something like quite slow and sparse and sad, and we just make it slower and sadder and more sparse until the end.
But it's
really
it's the sort of thing where you have to take the, in an album context, you sort of have to take a listener on a journey. Otherwise, you might as well just put out like a, you know, the best of Josie and Clark and Ben Walker sort of thing.
What exactly would that be?
Do you feel like shuffle mode is your enemy?
Yeah.
I think it's going to kill the classic album, certainly. Playlists. You know, I love a playlist, but that's not how you should structure your music. I mean, I think the resurgence of vinyl will kind of help keep the album context alive.
It's interesting because most people talk about the resurgence of vinyl as being all about the purer sound, but the idea of a consciously made album is underrated part of it.
Yeah, I think it has as much to do with kind of artwork and the ceremony of listening to music.
Completely the context, isn't it?
Yeah, and the kind of the idea of structuring an album. Like with vinyl, you have to turn it over halfway through, so you have to structure a classic album. It has to have a first half and then a second half, and you have to think very carefully about how those work. And I kind of think that it's no coincidence that at the moment when you've got all the kind of like digital streaming, there's no artwork, there's no kind of anything physical involved in it, and they're kind of like random tracks that can end up on shuffle or on a playlist or whatever, that there's been a kind of counterculture of people that still want a proper artistic project. That you're trying to make a classic album, whether or not you are successful in that endeavour is not for you to decide, but that's what you should be striving for.
I think it's actually good in the sense that, I mean, you know, you take some of the classic albums and how they were, even down to the artwork and the packaging, what we were saying before about how it's put together. And, you know, I've got a second-hand copy of Quadrophenia or something like that back at home, and it's amazing. It's, you know, it's a proper hardback book, gatefold kind of process, and you sit down and you read through it, and it's like reading an art. It's like having an art book sat on the coffee table, but it happens to contain a record
there's
in it.
Like a popular clothes store that I shall not mention by name now, that's started selling like classic reissued vinyl. So it's got like Rumours, Fleetwood Mac Rumours, and like Miles Davis albums. And like we were just kind of looking at them going, wow, these are all like great albums that have been reissued for vinyl. And they're in a kind of like standard high street store. And that tells you all you need to know.
And there really was something to be said for seeing the picture on the front and then opening it up and seeing the picture go across the fold.
Yeah. That's like a whole poster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, it's been a delight to chat with both of you, Josiane Clark and Ben Walker. Thank you so much. Enjoy the remaining few days you have in the U.S. and come back and see us again.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And do you have one more song to play for us?
We do, yes. This is a cover of Jackson C. Frank's Milk and Honey that, for reasons still unknown to us, we decided to mix with the jazz standard Tis Autumn. The kids call that a mashup. So this is a mashup of Milk and Honey and Tis Autumn. Yada.
Josiane Clark and Ben Walker's new album is called Overnight. We spoke with them recently when they were in town for a concert at the Collectivo back room. Our in-studio session was recorded by John Strelecki, and you can hear the full interview and all three songs they played for us at WUWM.com.
Soft and gentle.
Thank you for joining us for some of our favorite music interviews of the past year. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
My true love sighs. Autumn's leaving. Winter's coming. I think that I'll be moving on. I've got to leave him and find another.
It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.